From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when President Donald Trump blocked someone on Twitter. The president has made a habit of blocking people who give him a hard time, and he's hardly the only elected leader to do so. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez also blocks Twitter users with regularity. That could be the only thing they have in common, but the courts have not been okay with this. Let's start with Trump. The Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University sued the president in federal court, arguing against Twitter blocks. And in July, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the critics suing the president did, in fact, have their First Amendment rights violated because they were excluded from accessing the president's communication in, quote, this new metaphysical public forum. But Ocasio-Cortez is arguing that her Twitter blocks are different. She says she has two separate accounts, one professional, one personal, even though she tweets about official business from both. And Ocasio-Cortez says she blocks someone when they are harassing her, which she says happens often, not when they're just disagreeing. And she's asking the courts to back her up. Once again, the Knight Institute is stepping in to argue against an elected leader's right to block or ban on social media. At the heart of this case is a question about how seriously we should take, for example, President Trump on Twitter. The courts seem to be saying it doesn't matter where the communication happens. It's all a form of public communication and it can't be suppressed. But Trump's allies often say things like, well, we like his policies, but we wish he wouldn't tweet. So just don't take his tweeting seriously. Just the other day, the president tweeted or retweeted more than 60 times in a couple of hours. That was his weekend morning. Let's have a conversation about the law, the president, our elected leaders, and how we all communicate. Our guests this hour include in studio Scott Maloof, an attorney whose practice is focused on the intersection of social media and the law. Welcome back to the program, Scott.
Thanks, Evan. Good to be here.
And on the line with us is Roy Gutterman, who's director of the Tully Center for Free Speech and associate professor of magazine, news, and digital journalism at the Newhouse School at Syracuse University. Roy, welcome. How are you?
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, Scott, I'll start with you because you reached out to us about a month ago. In fact, you pointed us to Roy's piece in Syracuse.com as one example of the kinds of ways that the public is following what the courts are saying versus what President Trump is saying versus what Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez are saying. What do we know about where the courts are so far about who's allowed to block who on Twitter?
Okay. You know, the top line news is basically that two things. One, there are a number of opinions. Most of them have said generally when an account, even a personal account, is used for government official type business, you cannot block people based upon their viewpoints. And there's a lot of nuance to that. There have been some courts that have gone the other way, but that's the general rule. And by the way, cases have come up not just at the federal level, but you're seeing local and state officials have the same issue.
Okay. And is there a reasonable appeal here? I mean, following Ocasio-Cortez's case, she's going to try to make the distinction between blocking based on opinions or views versus harassment. I mean, do we expect that to carry any water here?
Right. So two things. One, with regard to President Trump's case, I believe he has a petition into the Second Circuit to hear it en banc, which means instead of having three judges, you have a panel of more judges because it's a very important case and revisit this. You know, and it's up to the court whether they're going to do that. And I believe, obviously, he may appeal to the Supreme Court. We don't have any inside knowledge of that. As to her case, it's in a different space. It was filed literally the day that the Second Circuit came down with the opinion on President Trump's case. And, you know, it is at the fact-finding stage. She has apparently just agreed that she's going to testify in a bit of a hearing that they're going to have about how she's using it. And that's the other big takeaway, is this isn't just you have a federal or a government account, you can't block anybody. It's really fact-intensive. I think her argument is, as you alluded to, is I'm not blocking because of the content, because someone's criticizing me. I'm blocking because it's harassing. You know, and a good example would be all these sites that run, like Facebook, Twitter. None of us would ever want them to allow viruses to be on those sites. So they may say, look, we're taking down a lot of content because we think it's a virus or some other, you know, very technical reason that's a bad thing. So it's the gradients. We're finding out, are you closer to a virus or are you closer to, I don't like what that person's saying about me?
Okay. Roy, how do you view the importance of these decisions? And generally speaking, how do you feel about Twitter blocks from elected leaders?
Well, first off, I don't agree with politicians blocking anybody from Twitter if this is how they choose to communicate with the public and float policy issues and just talk to people. Then they forfeit that right to block people. And in some ways, it's a great mechanism for politicians to communicate with ordinary people. But I think once they open that door, that's going to be a public forum, and you can't block people from that.
But Roy, again, let's hit what Trump supporters often say, and I can think of local Republican leaders here in Monroe County who often say things like, you know, we wish you wouldn't tweet. You know, it's not always the best. You know, he's kind of clumsy on Twitter, but you know, that's not. It's just Twitter. It's not really. We shouldn't take that seriously. Do you agree with that? That we should take that less seriously in some fashion?
I mean, some of the nonsense that comes out, we probably shouldn't regard with a lot of respect. But when you fire and hire high-ranking government officials and cabinet members through this medium, then we have to take it seriously. And regardless of how we feel about some of the content, when the president of the United States tweets or posts on social media, we have to pay attention to it. It's the office speaking, not necessarily the individual.
Do you think that this has gotten to a point, Roy, where you know, even if the president's acolytes would like him to gear it back, that it is sort of too late here? In other words, that this form of communication is so direct and immediate that we are going to see elected leaders use it or some kind of social media in some fashion? Or do you think there's going to be kind of a course correction post-Trump where it's much more buttoned up in terms of the communication that people have?
I think this has changed the way politicians are going to communicate and issue their statements. It allows politicians to totally circumvent the institutional press, and they get a lot of bang for their buck on this because they get the message out, and then if it's newsworthy, they'll get a day or two of press coverage, and all the while they don't have to talk to reporters who are going to ask questions that they don't want to answer.
That is such a good point here. And listeners, I will tell you this. We have talked to even some local leaders who have said that they feel like they can now speak directly to the public without the need for journalists. And what Roy is saying here, we should all think about what that means. And listeners, if you want to weigh in on how we communicate Twitter blocks, whether you think it's an effective form of communication or not, particularly with the president, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. But Roy, for someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she's not saying, I don't want people to be able to access my communication on Twitter. She's saying, if someone is harassing me, I ought to be able to block them. Do you disagree with that?
A private citizen would have that right. You know, my problem with invoking harassment is it's such a malleable standard. It's open to a lot of potential interpretation. I'm not quite sure what she says is harassment. I'm sure there are people saying awful things about her, probably the worst things you can imagine. But, you know, that vitriol goes with the office, whether you're a president or a U.S. representative or, you know, a parks commissioner who has access to the public. It goes with the territory, and it's just now it's so public and in your face, and it can go viral, whereas probably 20, 30 years ago, you'd get a hate mail in the mail, and that would be that. But, you know, nobody wants to be harassed. Nobody wants to have awful things said about them. But to a certain extent, that right is forfeited once you seek office and hold office.
All right. So, Attorney Maloof, if you become Judge Maloof and you are adjudicating this particular claim by the congresswoman that this is different, that harassment should be the standard, not just you can't block, are you sympathetic to the argument?
Well, Evan, you know,
and I don't hear you laughing because you're laughing at harassment, but just because the idea of role-playing a judge, it's impossible to get in the judge's head. I get that.
I'm not laughing at harassment. I'm laughing at the fact that if you asked me, you know, before I got appointed as a judge, I would give you an answer that didn't answer anything. I'd say, I'm going to call strikes and balls on you, Evan.
Yeah, exactly. But Roy's point about standards of harassment is an important one.
Roy's point is an excellent point on harassment and its malleability, because one person may see, you know, this really aggressive message as harassment. You know, secondly, there's a pattern, right? I can send you a message that says, Evan, I disagree with you. Let's say you're an elected representative. I send you one. That's not harassing. I send you the same message, Evan, I disagree with you, 57 times in, say, 3 days. You may say, now it's the pattern, the method, and that is harassing. And we've actually already had a real example of what Roy alluded to, which is Kamala Harris a few days ago called, she wrote a letter to her campaign, wrote a letter to Jack Dorsey, the president of Twitter, and said, I believe that some of the president's tweets about Representative Schiff out in California, his tweets about civil war and things like that, are violations of the terms of service of Twitter. They are, you know, inappropriate behaviors as Twitter has defined it, you should suspend his account. So we've already seen that kind of thing where one person is trying to say the rules, you know, should be used here. The other thing I would say is you asked an earlier question, are we going to go back to a place where people aren't going to use it, politicians aren't going to use it? And we have to remember that this is a very different method of communication, right? You know, it's not I give an interview and that, or maybe some videos created. It's I am, you know, now doing a live stream. I'm doing reactions to what other people do. It's very different than what would have occurred in the past. And it's also much more emotive. If you look at what marketers are doing, they're using a lot of personal stories, a lot of emotive storytelling. And it's no surprise that people in the political world will pick up on those tools.
Yeah, you know, Scott's right. I mean, there is, it seems like every week lately, there's a legal challenge or a debate about what the president is tweeting. And we're going to get back to the notion of whether it should be okay for the president to warn about a possible civil war in the event of his impeachment. But before we do that, let me grab our first phone call. It's Jane in Rochester. Go ahead, Jane.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was going to say, bringing up the war scare. But this is just personal for me how I feel about Twitter, which I'm very out of step with everybody. But it just seems like when a president talks about extremely serious things and uses Twitter, it seems to diminish it, and it's less dignified and with gravitas. You know, when they have something important to say in the past, that was, you know, it's going to be on the news at 6 o'clock this evening, the president will speak, that sort of thing. And it really, to me, Twitter is Trump's own best enemy because it exposes his what seems to be such instability. You know, on Monday it's war, on Tuesday it's not war, that sort of thing. You know, what happened, we're going to go to war with Iran. And it just diminishes the whole thing. But I say party on if it's going to diminish him. But you would think that by now, somehow, the Republican Party, just for reasons of maintaining power, would have had a little talk with him about how he comes across as being possibly too impulsive and unstable, conflicting in what he says. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane. And that implies that the president would listen to leaders in the Republican Party. And I think we have seen that movie enough to know how that would end. But Roy, she brings up an interesting point. In her view, she's someone who doesn't like the president. She thinks his Twitter usage will probably inflict political damage on him. But there's also the implication in her phone call that whether it's Donald Trump, AOC, anybody else, if we see that and can access their tweets, and there's a lot of them, it's revelatory of character or ideas or thought process, and it is still valuable to the public or journalists. Do you agree, Roy?
To a certain extent, I agree with that. You know, different politicians have, you know, a more dignified social media feed and use it probably a little more responsibly than we see currently out of the White House. So, you know, responsible use of social media can be effective and can really be valuable for our marketplace of ideas and discussion of public issues.
I'm looking at some reporting from The Verge, among others, just to sort of put a fine point on what Scott Maloof was talking about. So, Senator and 2020 presidential candidate Kamala Harris has formally asked Twitter to suspend the president's Twitter account following Trump's attacks on a whistleblower and his claim that impeachment could start a civil war. In an open letter to Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey, Kamala Harris says that Trump has used Twitter to, quote, target, harass, there's that word again, and attempt to out the person who filed an explosive complaint about Trump pressuring Ukraine to dig up dirt on rival candidate Joe Biden, end quote. Scott, I am not an attorney, and I'm glad to recognize my lack of expertise. But that, to me, from Senator Harris, looks like a political stunt rather than an actual legally backable claim to suspend a president's account. What do you think?
Yeah, before I came on, I looked at the letter, and I would ask folks, you know, if you're truly interested, go take a look at the letter and see, because you'll want to see the context. What are the tweets? Two things. One, none of them, at a quick reading by me, seem like this is a threat, what we traditionally think of as a threat. Evan, I am going to come to your house in XYZ. So it felt more like here is someone that maybe is possibly gaming the system. And we've heard, you know, pressure in the past of people saying you should knock the president off because he's violating terms of service, other terms of the service. And Twitter has publicly wrestled with that issue because they say even if someone this important does, there still needs to be that methodology of communicating. Secondly, just one thing I noticed in her letter, she did not include links to each of those individual tweets. And that to me felt like you undermine the seriousness of it, because if I'm at Twitter, I want to see exactly what that is. And that kind of all loops back into the lawsuit originally filed against the president. The central point for the Second Circuit was, you know, the functionality that the platform provides, the people who can follow, see what he says, comment, critique, communicate. Once you lose these functionalities that the electronic platform provides, then speech has a burden. And that's what we as a society want to avoid, the burden of people expressing and experiencing.
Professor Gutterman, do you take Senator Harris's call for the suspension of Trump's Twitter account seriously?
No, but I'm surprised somebody actually read an entire terms of service agreement and her staff.
Scott, you're always surprised when people actually read those things, aren't you, as an attorney?
They are exhausting when you read through them, and they constantly change.
That's a whole other subject. Those are designed to be exhausting. you and your ilk who write those things. Scott's going, don't blame me for that.
Evan, look, I'm the victim here. My prescription keeps getting stronger and stronger.
But Roy, on the subject of civil war, I want to at least address what, not just what Senator Harris is saying, but people like Jane who called in, who said that kind of a tweet should be taken seriously because of how provocative it can seem at a moment when we're obviously politically divided. But the Trump mentality seems to be, if you try to go down this road, get ready for some kind of insurrection. And if it comes from the president himself, is there something that goes to a different level for you there, Roy?
I mean, it's troubling that it just seems like the tweets just, you know, whatever's on his mind at any given moment seems to go out there, and it does nothing to minimize the division or bring people together. I mean, the office of the president is obviously political, but it's also a unifying office for the country. And when the sitting president tweets out a declaration of a civil war, that's certainly not bringing people together. I mean, you would expect more from leadership. You really would.
Is that one more for the analysts and less for the lawyers, the president talking about civil war in a tweet, Scott Maloof?
Yeah, I think that's more for it. There's a piece by Professor Cass Sunstein, which talks about, you know, how the Constitution treats language like that and where it falls in, So as well as responses to it. So I think it is closer to the analysts. And this is very frustrating because, you know, we see the divisiveness being highlighted, but, you know, I have seen many people. There's a conference, Upstate Social, going on right now in town, and there's people who have said, here's how it's brought me together. Here is how social media has exposed me to other, you know, ways of thinking. It's made me more conscientious about what I do and about how other people experience things. And that's, you know, Roy put his finger on it. It's about the ethics and how we communicate and try and be respectful of others, even though we have rights that may say you can go farther to the extreme about what you say and what you do.
All right, so more feedback here. Steve says, regarding Twitter blocks, Trump is supposed to represent the entire country, while AOC is representing her district. In my opinion, AOC shouldn't be allowed to block people from her district, but she owes nothing to people outside of her district. Scott Maloof, what do you think?
I understand the appeal of that. I think it would be difficult because there's plenty of people outside one's district who are stakeholders. Journalists, for example, you know. Secondly, you have senators who represent an entire state. And so do you say, okay, well, you represent, 10, 18 million people, but what, once it crosses state lines, you can start blocking. I don't think that's how a court would look at it. The court would say, yes, constituency adds an additional element. It's even more important these people communicate. But you may have a very fierce critic who just happens to live across the line or across the country who you still should speak to. Because remember, the people are on the federal payroll, right? We all pay taxes. And so the platform has been elevated because you are a federal employee.
Okay. Roy, what do you make of that?
Well, she, I mean, her constituency is her district, but she's also a national policymaker now. I mean, the minute she was elected, she became one of the faces of the new Democratic Party. So, you know, she's got to listen to people from everywhere. I agree with that.
Okay.
And there's just a practical aspect. How difficult it is to verify, you know, on Twitter. Twitter does not require you to use a real name. So how do you verify? Should we force a person who's anonymous but a strong critic to say, oh, I am X and I live in your district? I mean, as we really start digging through this, this can be a very difficult thing to do.
Well, should we? I think you're saying we shouldn't.
No, we shouldn't. Their anonymous speech has a long tradition in this country. It's very valuable. You know, the Federalist Papers were published by Publius, right? And they went around to papers all over the country, the internet of their day, and they were anonymous. And so we have the Constitution, we have the country we have because of anonymous speech. So we shouldn't just randomly discard it. You know, and we're seeing, remember, governments are using these tools across the world. You're seeing, you know, people are criticizing what's going on in China with the extensive, you know, social credit scores and forcing people to always use real names. And so that is a chilling tool that we have to be very concerned with.
Yeah, I mean, there are times where my knee jerk is to say online anonymity is cowardly, but I understand how important and functional and protective it is for many people. And so I have to kind of pull myself back from that mentality because while it may be cowardly at times, it may be actually just practical at times.
Every tool has ups and downs. You know, we can see how people use anonymous speech to abuse others, but we can also see how it gives people the ability to get information or to share information they would not feel comfortable otherwise.
Let me get back to your phone calls. Rich in Rochester next. Go ahead, Rich.
Hi, Evan. How are you doing?
Very good, sir.
My biggest concern with all of this is that we have taken what's taken as extreme 20 years ago, 30 years by a president, because of Trump's constant just beating of the drum, has become the norm. So saying something about like a civil war, I don't think we take it seriously enough. I don't. I listen to even the responses from your guests, and they almost are poo-pooing it to a certain level. His the way he's attacking the impeachment process. He's trying to say that what he is doing is normal. What he is doing is good. And by constantly drumming these messages, he is moving the bar and moving that needle to what is considered decorum, what is considered the norm in this country, and what is considered effective diplomacy. There's not one thing that a president has done or should do that needle has not been moved by this man in the way he does.
Okay,
it.
But Rich,
that is the real danger.
But let me work through something with you first, Rich, before I kick it to our guests, which is I understand your point about the president's comments about a possible civil war in the case of impeachment. I mean, that seems extreme and frankly a little vile to even think about. But you also say that the president is trying to normalize his attacks on impeachment. I don't know any president or any elected leader who, if they were impeached and felt it were unjust, wouldn't attack the process in some way to try to clear their own name or sort of make their case. The president ought to be allowed to try to make his case, shouldn't he, Rich?
Oh, yeah. There's a difference between making your case and just going after institutions, going after processes, going after everything. He uses the same tactics that he uses when he would get sued in the private industry. He's doing the same thing. He's taken this level of vitriol to another level. It's just like when the Supreme Court said, you know, when you see porn, you know when you see these things. I can't define it exactly explicitly. But you know when the quorum has gone to another level.
Yeah, I do understand that. But it also strikes me as what you're saying is we ought to at least publicly have a discourse that recognizes it, if not a legal response. That's a different thing. Or are you?
Go ahead.
I just want to make sure I understand what you're calling on not only our guests, but sort of listeners to think about here, because there are legal mechanisms for dealing with speech of this sort, and then there is just sort of the way that we sort of have cultural norms here. And it sounds to me like you think the cultural norms or the norms of the office are being violated.
Yeah, I think the norms are being violated. And with that, what is allowed and what is accepted by us as a country is being it's a hard word, debased, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
It's being pushed to a level that a president can lie profusely and then turn around and attack someone for the one lie they told 30 years ago, and somehow that is equal. There's this perversion of everything going on right here. I don't even know how to explain it, but I've never seen the level of perversion from people that we expect higher ethics and higher morals from.
Okay, I know Scott wants to jump in. My last question for you, Rich, before I let our guest respond, is what do you want journalists to do about that, given the way you see the landscape now?
I don't know. I think a lot of journalists are pushing back on it and are saying these things. It's Evan. This is, we're in a new territory. I wish I had the answer.
I'm listening. Go ahead, Scott Maloof.
Yeah, I take a bit of umbrage at what Rich says, because what I'm trying to express, and I'm hoping I express it a little more clearly, is that the First Amendment, the idea of political discourse or all kinds of discourse, is very broad. Speech that all of us, you know, or a lot of people may find offensive, may still be protected by the First Amendment. And yeah, Rich, I agree with you. I don't like the pulling down of the standards. And frankly, I tweeted the other day about a federal judge who said, from the president on down, you know, we are seeing a lack of civility, a lack of elevation of discourse. But you have to recognize the difference between making that comment, all of us individually, politically, saying we expect more, we expect better standards and more ethics, and enforcing that with the law. And Rich brought up impeachment. I just want to mention a public resource for everybody. The New York State Bar Association is having a session called Impeachment, A Guide to the Legal Process and Its History. It's a free webinar, and it's in October 15th. So check out that resource to understand more about the process, the law, and the history behind it.
Let me let Roy respond, and then we'll see if Rich wants to follow up. Go ahead, Roy.
Well, the current state of debate and rhetoric that's coming out of the White House reflects the campaign that he ran. And as an outsider, he said he's going to change the system. He doesn't, and he's obviously doing that. And you know, there seems to be little regard for some of the governmental institutions and processes, and there doesn't seem to be a viable check on that. So, I mean, I agree with your caller to a certain extent, but you know, as far as the debate goes, you know, even the Second Circuit in the opinion acknowledged the difficulty and somewhat of something of the irony that we're dealing with, where we have more access to communication and more exchange of information, and to a certain extent, some of it is great and some of it's garbage, and you know, we leave it to viewers, readers, and followers to figure out what counts and what should be discarded.
Okay. Rich, you want to add anything there?
I guess in the end, it's the totality of this picture. Not only is it his speech, for me, I'm seeing everything happening. Like you said, the attacks on the institutions, not only the attacks, almost the dissolution of some of our institutions and some of the more effective ways of governing, even if I didn't agree with a conservative or whoever was making a decision, at least this dissolution and this almost destruction of our institutions happening before my eyes. I know it sounds pretty extreme in language, but I don't know what else to call it. So I guess the speech part is just part and parcel to it all. And I guess for me, it all starts coming together. It's just, for me, it's a scary thing, because where does this leave us if he doesn't get elected, or whatever happens, when he leaves the White House, where does this leave us as a country? And that's what I'm seeing.
Rich, thanks as always. I appreciate that, and a lot of food for thought. And listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about sort of a range of issues, first related to what the courts have to say about what the president and leaders like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez can and can't do on social media. When it comes to blocking the public, the president and Ocasio-Cortez have both been embroiled in legal cases in which they are defending their Twitter blocks. And so far, the courts have essentially said, you can't do that. Real quick, Scott Maloof, when AOC says, look, I've got a personal account and a professional account, and I may tweet from both, but one is not the same as the other, does that hold any weight?
No, the president's account, the account that at issue, real Donald Trump, was a personal account, is a personal account. He opened it in 2009, and he's continued to use it. He has a Twitter account called @POTUS.
POTUS, yeah.
Right. So,
which Obama used before him.
Exactly. Yeah. So two things. One, I really did think the courts would say it's really not of a moment that it's your personal account, because as soon as you got that office, you replaced it, and you're using your personal account.
Same with AOC.
Same with AOC. And secondly, a big issue, a knock-on issue that we're seeing is what happens when these folks leave office? Because right now you're using federal resources. You're using, you know, for example, attorneys to defend you. You're using your staff to create this. Where does that account go? We had this with Nikki Haley, where the State Department made her give up the account that she used, and she had to create a new one. So that's another really interesting issue because, for example, we want to see all these messages archived, and the National Archives is saving it, but there may be additional functionalities that we want as a country to keep in all of these kinds of accounts. And secondly, is it fair if somebody leaves office and says, all right, now I want to sell hosiery, and I'm going to use my 52 million people to tell you about great socks?
Yeah.
You know, is that what we want as a nation?
All right, so we have a flood of listener feedback, a lot of interesting points and questions and comments from listeners, and if you're on the line, we'll get to you after our only short break of the hour. You just heard Scott Maloof, an attorney whose practice focuses on the intersection of social media and the law, Roy Gutterman, director of the Tully Center for Free Speech and an associate professor of magazine news and digital journalism at the Newhouse School at Syracuse University. More of your feedback next. Coming up in our second hour, it's the launch of Current Scene in Rochester. It is a big day for the local arts community. So what is Current Scene? Well, it's a new program happening at small and mid-sized venues across downtown. And artists say, you know what the Jazz Festival is. You know what the Fringe Festival is. You ought to know what Current Scene is. They want it on that level. And they're going to tell us all about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Adam in Rochester is next on the phone. Go ahead, Adam.
Good afternoon. I'd like to just briefly ask your callers to discuss the incident concerning Father Coughlin and his newspaper, Social Justice, and his radio show, which was taken off the air in, I believe, 1939. And I believe the cause was sedition. At what point does free speech become sedition, especially after the most recent of tweets supporting Jim Jeffress and his calls to civil war? And I'll let the callers respond.
Yeah, Adam, thank you. So I am not a scholar on Father Coughlin, but my understanding is he was viewed as sort of a pioneer in using radio in the 1930s very effectively. He had an audience that reached into, I think, a million listeners. And, you know, according to the New York Times, his sermons and his weekly magazine, Social Justice, became instruments of, among other things, anti-Semitism. There would be rallies in which groups would bring up his name. It would set off wild cheering. He said in 1936, I take the road of fascism. And then it was after the United States formally entered World War II, which he opposed, the entry of the United States into World War II, that Father Coughlin's radio voice was essentially silenced. His magazine was forced out of business. He was taken off the air. The efforts of the Roman Catholic Church and the federal government, among others, united against him. So this was a voice who used what was as much the social media at the time, the new form of technology, as much as he could. So, Roy, is there any historical lesson? And you know, is the word sedition relevant to you here?
You know, the use of traditional broadcasting, radio, over-the-air radio, over-the-air television, falls under a totally different set of regulations governed by the FCC. And at the heart of that is the responsible use of the airwaves. So, you know, an anti-Semitic, anti-government radio broadcast, even in the early stages of mass media, would have been an irresponsible use of the airwaves. It would be grounds for it to be taken off the air. As far as sedition goes, it's technically on the books, but it has not been really enforced. I mean, the Times v. Sullivan Supreme Court decision from 1964 pretty much said that criticizing the government cannot be prosecuted, so, you know, much civilly or even criminally. So I don't think we have much grounds for a sedition trial in the 21st century.
Okay. Scott Maloof?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. One, we have to remember that the courts have generally moved to protecting more and more speech, probably since Father Coughlin's time, you know, where we've seen more cases of the First Amendment having people say things that are stronger, you know, whether it's words against police officers or vulgarity. And so, I don't think I would look at those cases and say, you know, it's a really good line of argument. Secondly, you know, there's an article, I mentioned it earlier, by Cass Sunstein in the Seattle Times about treason being defined in the Constitution. It's the only crime defined in the Constitution. And if you read that together with the First Amendment, you know, you see that you can say a lot of things and not have those things fall into treason. It's much closer to the idea of you've got to act and you've got to aid the enemy or you've got to do something. So I'd say take a look at that article. And then finally, I had a friend who wrote a paper on Father Coughlin in college. So if you're listening, you know who you are. Call us with all the details.
Thank you. And Scott, briefly, again, legal ignorance here, but the penalty for treason is pretty serious in this country. If you're found guilty of treason, they don't really let you go out in public anymore alive.
Well, I mean, I think if we let's take a step back and put this in the social media context, we look at a lot of the terrorism cases, you know, of aiding and assisting, you know, an enemy. And so it's you're providing that material support. And any kind of crime on the federal level is incredibly serious. That's the way I would tackle that.
Here's why I bring this up. Because the president recently referred to Congressman Adam Schiff from California as being engaged in treason. He did that on Twitter.
Yeah.
Could Adam Schiff or anyone make the argument that given that Trump has 65 million voters and something like 65 million Twitter followers, I think 62 million voters, and I know we are counting, but tens of millions of followers, that if he makes a claim that a member of Congress has actually committed treason, that is a form of harassment that could put someone in danger if some of his followers take the law into their own hands there?
Yeah, I would take a step away from the legal side of that. I mean, the legal thing that would concern me most is that here's the executive officer. He or she is in charge of law enforcement resources and priorities and is talking to the Department of Justice, the Attorney General. And so, you know, concern being, do you put a person like the congressman in the sights of an investigative power when they're, you know, executing their role as a congressperson saying, I'm speaking out and I'm talking about this? So that's one big concern. But you get into the softer area, and I don't mean softer as in easier, but softer as in the boundaries are harder to see of when we are talking about something on social media, are we putting a person at risk with the language we use because there is a small subset of people out there who may take the wrong thing? This is like Pizzagate that happened a few years back, where you had someone who went to Washington, D.C., and he took, a rifle with him, and he went into this pizza shop, you know, based on this conspiracy theory that was being pushed forward. It's a real concern because, you know, we are a nation of 330-some-odd million people. You know, almost, you know, any one thing may inspire one individual person, but we can't reduce our discussion to that level because then you can quickly see we have nothing to discuss. This is a children issue. It comes up a lot with children and broadcasting where you say, you know, what are the hours? And the FCC, you know, and I think the courts have said, we got a safe time period, you know, when kids are awake. And then after that, it's kind of a broader spectrum. That really doesn't work, obviously, with the internet.
Well, Professor Gutterman, going back to the idea that some people ask us not to take the president seriously on Twitter, it is impossible for me to envision a world in which Ronald Reagan or Barack Obama would invoke treason in any form of communication regarding a political opponent. And yet this president does it, and people just sort of shrug. It's kind of like, yeah, you know, that's what he said about Schiff. I mean, we are desensitized, aren't we, Roy?
I think we're desensitized, and I think there's a lot of eye rolling and head shaking, but and the normal critics, the usual critics, line up and air their grievances and their outrage. But people close to the president or in the same party aren't wagging their judgmental finger at him with all this fiery rhetoric. I mean, I don't think any reasonable person would believe that somebody that's part of the opposition party would be engaged in treason, but this rhetoric goes out there, and and it just it deflects, and this is what we end up talking about for 2 or 3 days.
Yeah. Back to the phones. So you want to add to that?
No, I'd just say, you know, it goes back to a lot of what we've talked about. It's incumbent upon us as voters, as users, to push back when we see activities like this that we don't like, you know, and make our voices heard to say, you know, this is unacceptable, you know.
Countering and, speech that's reckless with more speech?
Right, right. And it's funny. That's exactly what has traditionally been in. And the court, there's a little bit from the Second Circuit, which said that, where they said, you know, at the end of the case about the president, it said, if the First Amendment means anything, it means that the best response to disfavored speech is more speech, not less. And that's, you know, you hear this language, you don't like this language, make that, you know, distaste known, both in action and online, because don't think just because you put a tweet out there, you did your job. It's much more to say you've got to put yourself in the real world and get real world results.
Bonnie in Rochester, next on the phone. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, hi. This is, of course, a very difficult subject because it's been talked about. It doesn't kind of fall in easy, so quote unquote, characteristics. But here's what I think. Let's just say when you think about people who in history have been kind of brutal dictators, there's a lot of common behavior in those folks, you know, from Hitler and you can name others. And if you look at Trump's behaviors, although he hasn't picked up anything to shoot anybody or he's not a mass murderer yet anyway, his behaviors, the way he uses psychology to twist people is very effective. He's not a very bright person, the usual way we know that, but he is. When he says he's a genius, and we talked about the art of the deal, he doesn't mean what most people probably think of that, at least before he was elected. He means these things he always uses to get to people. He knows how to play the people who are maybe more emotionally vulnerable. Some of his followers, so he uses, you know, redirecting things. He uses accusing this one and that one, which clouds the whole issue. He lies. And those aren't things he does just occasionally. He does them all the time. That is not normal behavior. We all kind of do some of that a little bit, but we don't do it that way. So there's something that I think is missing. And I know this is a tricky discussion because mental health, you know, you need to respect people in terms of all that, which is valid. But how far do you take it? Because I would like to see some of the journalists and some of the people coming on to speak to this issue more. If you don't hear it, you know, from people who are used to dealing with folks like this, which, you know, and that's another point. I mean, most average Americans don't come in contact, at least to this degree, with a lot of with a Trump-like person. So to them, it's like, oh, well, mostly just this or this or this. Well, no, it's much more than that. And that needs to come out a lot more because it helps explain.
So how, though, Bonnie? So what should we do about it, Bonnie?
Well, I again, as I said in the beginning, this is not an easy thing. I would like to see, let me pick on journalists a little bit here.
Sure.
I would like to see them, and this is not the only issue, see them take a little bit more intense involvement or education or whatever, you know, frame it different ways in these areas, and especially in sociopathic kind of personalities. So people that you don't run into a lot, but yet they have a huge impact on our country, on the world. So that would be helpful because then maybe in that dialogue and that learning open process, there would be some ways. For instance, why does the media give him so much time? If it were me, once I realized what he was doing, I would say, I'm sorry, you have 2 minutes and that's it. And the other side can have 2 minutes too, but the 2 minutes he gets can't be, you know, reduce some of his mumbling on and on about this one did that one. So, I mean, that's just one kind of approach. I think the awareness of the public is also very significant. And we don't teach people, you know, because especially we don't want to start out teaching people about the worst example of somebody with a really twisted mind. But we need to be open about there are these situations. And if we don't have people aware of them, we're going to continue. He doesn't stop. Nothing stops him. He has no barrier, no boundaries whatsoever.
Yeah.
So that's one of the. So anyway, that's.
Bonnie, thank you for that. And Professor Gutterman, I'm going to start with you. So there's a lot there, starting with the fact that she thinks the media overcovers everything he does and says. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do agree with that to a certain extent because it's easy. It's easy to to report on a tweet and then go to the usual suspects for the opposition quote, and then we have a story. Complex issues take time to report. They take resources, and unfortunately, we're seeing the shrinking of the institutional press. And we're seeing the outcome of that. You know, local newspapers, local TV stations, local radio is doing less and less hard news reporting. And, that's the reality of the business and the shift in the way news operations can make money and lose money. So, we're seeing kind of a multifaceted decline here at the same time when we need more and more coverage of this.
And let me pick up one thing from what Roy said. If you're doing your reporting and you're doing that groundwork on Twitter, on Facebook, as more people get kicked off of those platforms or the type of speech on those platforms gets more restricted, if that's where you're getting your facts, there may be opinions, there may be experiences that are not being reflected. And so if you don't have the resources to go out and do your own legwork, the man in the street stuff, and you're only getting what comes off of those platforms, there may be a narrower silo of what we're getting instead of saying there's other, opinions and views.
Sarah writes to the program and says she doesn't think the guests take seriously enough just how rough the harassment of AOC, for example, can be. And Sarah says women in particular take online harassment at a different level than men do, and that ought to be recognized. I'll start with you, Scott. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's what we've seen, and we've seen that case. But every situation, we have to factually walk through it and say, how is this going? Because we're always concerned that someone puts their critics in harassment. In the example I gave, again, a person can send you a message, it's fine, and then they send you the same message 57 times. Maybe that 57 times is harassment. And we don't want to just leave it to the person administering the account, man, woman, whatever, because of the fact that they think there's a temptation to put a ton of people in harassment. That's why the court, I think, is going through a fact-finding process to say, what have you done? Show me the metrics. Show me the examples so I can understand
this. So it's not that it's impossible that she could prove a case, specific cases of online harassment, mm-hmm. and win. It's that it would have to be case by case, very specific and somewhat rare.
So the difference is you look at the president's account, it's kind of a free for all.
Yes.
And whereas if you were a politician, you said, okay, I've got a set of rules and this is what harassment is. So in her example, I think there have been some fake, nude images of her posted. And if she said, one of my rules is, these go down, I think a court might say, yeah, that's a really specific rule. It's not adding to this public debate. You can take that down. Same thing. Somebody's putting up viruses or putting up spam. Buy my vitamin supplements. You can take that down. But somebody says, you can block it. And that's a big issue. Twitter has there's always a variety of tools. There's blocking where you keep the whole account from commenting. There's muting. There's a bunch of things. And that's another reason we have to get into the facts of how exactly do you do this? When do you do it?
Roy, what would you say to Sarah's email regarding how rough women in particular in politics and on social media have it?
Well, it's not just politics. Female journalists take way more heat and take it at a personal level than male journalists. Actors and actresses. It's more than just a minor social media phenomenon. It's a reality. But, I keep going back to the fact that AOC is an elected official, and back to the Second Circuit opinion, just because somebody posts something on your account doesn't mean you have to read it.
Yeah, and we have to, each case is different. We got to look at the individual facts, because you may have, two very different kinds of people, two very different standards, and each of them may make sense. So we can't just say women are X, men are Y, and
All right,
let me make one other point.
Sure.
If there's a viable true threat, a legally definable true threat, that's not a free speech issue. And there has to be a line between fiery rhetoric, even hateful rhetoric, and a specific true threat. And if there's a specific true threat, she'd be totally entitled to at least monitor the speaker, the user, or even bring in law enforcement. But there's a big difference between a true threat and just something that you don't like.
Right, and that's if it's a threat or and it's concerning, you go forward and you say, I'm going to file this with law enforcement.
Yeah.
But the flip side, there was a case in Michigan where a judge felt a man's post, a man who had been litigating a case in family court, he lost custody of his child. A couple of years later, his child died in his wife's custody, and the man blamed the judge for this situation. The man put up a couple of posts, one showing him sort of with a shovel over his arms, and it had some initials of the judge and the clerk on it, but it didn't seem like it was a threat. The judge filed a complaint. The man went to trial over these threats, and the jury dismissed the case in 26 minutes, and they said this was not a true threat. So it kind of all loops back to it's very difficult to just say threat is X, this is what's going to happen. It's really fact-dependent.
It has to be direct. Okay. Yeah. Covered a lot of ground this hour. I want to thank our guest, Scott Maloof, an attorney here in Rochester, Scott Maloof, MALOUF.com, if you want to learn more and find his services. Thank you for being here, as
Thank
always.
You for having me.
And Roy Gutterman, director of the Tully Center for Free Speech and associate professor of magazine news and digital journalism at the Newhouse School at Syracuse University. Roy, we enjoyed having you. Let's do it again. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Very good. Short break, more connections coming up.